And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
And welcome, everybody, Hands on Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Machuda. And get ready for a great program where we are going to discuss how to explain, defend, and share the Catholic faith with clarity and charity. And, well, we have an incredible guest on, somebody that I have admired his work over a number of years. A true polymath, by the way, is Father Robert Spitzer. It's going to be coming into the dojo after the break, and we're going to talk about the existence of the soul. Are we just merely mechanical, biological creatures that have nothing beyond just physical processes in our brain? Or is there evidence that we do indeed transcend our physical bodies, that we have a spiritual soul? Well, Father Spitzer is going to come on board. We're going to talk about some really cool stuff, and I can't wait. It should be a great time. And also, as always, we're going to talk about our Finding the Fallacy and Meet the Early Church Father. But before I do that, well, let's change things up a little bit, and I'll give my shout-outs to those watching on social media, live stream, Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. It's great to see everyone, and yeah, thank you for the emoji explosion. Appreciate it. Yes, the sensei sends his greetings to the dojo corner of social media. Welcome to the program. Finding the Fallacy, by the way, is the Courtier's Reply, and also the Meet the Early Church Father. We're going to meet Pope St. Celestine I. So cool stuff. Lots of cool stuff going around. And by the way, you are part of this program. And when Father Spitzer comes on, you are more than welcome to give us a call and join the conversation at 888-526-2151. It's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. And I should also mention that we have a dojo mailbox, so maybe you would prefer to send an email. And we'd love to hear from you. Just send it to questions@handsonapologetics.com. One word, handsonapologetics.com. And questions@handsonapologetics.com flies through the internet into the dojo mailbox where I receive it. And I also try to reply to it, reply to all the emails, even though not all of them make it on the air. Nevertheless, you know, we are here to be lifelines, and I'm glad to help anybody out that I can help out. So, let's see, Dojo Mailbox, for those listening on podcast, via podcast, every program I mention this, this is the flagship website of Virgin Most Powerful Radio, which is virginmostpowerfulradio.org website. you can access all the episodes of Hands-On Apologetics, so maybe you have to run and you aren't able to listen to our interview with Father Spitzer. You can just go on virginmostpowerfulradio.org and click on our shows and select Hands-On Apologetics or any other great shows we produce. And bang, you're right there. You can download, you can share. And also, by the way, on the website is there are also features to help you support Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And you can do that right now, especially those, you know, and the part of the dojo on live stream. Don't forget to like us, to share us, tell people about us, because more people, the better. And you can also become a monthly donator and things, all the good stuff like that on virginmostpowerfulradio.org website. Okay, well, without further ado, why don't we jump into our critical thinking exercise, our Finding the Fallacy. Today's Finding the Fallacy is the Courtier's Reply, which is basically the dismissal of an opponent's position because the opponent isn't properly educated or doesn't hold the proper degrees, and so as to be able to propose a position, and the person dismisses them because they're not in the specialized field, they don't have particular degrees, they're not smart enough, and they dismiss it without explaining why the position is wrong or present evidence against their position. So basically, the coordinator's reply is similar to another fallacy known as the appeal to authority. If you remember, appeal to authority is you appeal to someone's authority in place of evidence, that this is an expert, the expert says X, therefore X is true. Well, this is kind of the reverse of that. It's when someone contests something that's being said, the person's position is dismissed because they don't have proper authority. So it's kind of like the opposite. Something to keep in mind. It is out there. And we need to be careful, too. When we're critiquing someone, we can point out that perhaps someone isn't lettered in a particular field. So they may be only as competent to discuss a particular position as you or I, right? Because someone could hold a doctorate in genetic engineering, but when it comes to metaphysics and philosophy, they're no more competent than you or I. You can point that out, but nevertheless, you always have to provide evidence and arguments. You can't ever just dismiss somebody because then you'd be committing this fallacy. All right, so let's talk about the Meet the Early Church Father for today. And today's Early Church Father is an early pope, Pope Celestine I, who reigned between AD 422 and AD 432. Pope Celestine is no small importance in dealing with the Eastern patriarchs, especially in regard to Nestorius and the Council of Ephesus in 431 AD. We have excerpts of his writings, mainly letters. And like I said, his pontificate stems from September 422 to July 432. Nothing's really known about his early history. He appears to have been Roman by birth. And we know his father's name was Priscus. That's about it. We probably lived at the time of St. Ambrose, and first notice of him is made in a document by Pope St. Innocent I in 416, where he spoke of Celestine the Deacon. He succeeded St. Boniface I as Pope on September 10th, 422, reigned 9 years, 10 months, 16 days, and in spite of the tumultuous time in Rome, he was elected without any opposition. He had a very strong friendship with St. Augustine, and in fact, after St. Augustine's death, Celestine wrote a long letter to the bishops of Gaul on St. Augustine's sanctity, his learning, his zeal as a holy doctor. He also forbade all attacks upon his memory in regards to the heresy of semi-Pelagianism. So in a sense, you know, while semi-Pelagianism still reigned or was still a hot issue after Augustine's death, the Pope says, you know, he didn't want any of these semi-Pelagians to besmirch the integrity of the St. Augustine's reputation. But nevertheless, you know, his pontificate was rocked with several heresies he had to combat. The Manichaeans, who believed in a kind of that there was a good God and an evil God. It was like barely Christian. The Donatists, the Novationists, and the Pelagians, as I already mentioned. Not to mention that there were barbarian hordes that were making their inroads into the heart of the empire during his pontificate. But Celestine's firm but gentle character enabled him to meet successfully with all the agencies of his position in all these areas. So he upheld church rights and dignity of offices and was a good, solid pope. The last years of his pontificate, Celestine took up the struggle in the East over the heresy of Nestorius. Now remember, Nestorius was the one who so separated the natures of Christ that Christ almost was like two people instead of a person. And Nestorius became bishop in Constantinople in 428. And he started welcoming, by the way, at first, you know, the Pope was warm to him. He thought he was Orthodox, but then Nestorius started welcoming these Pelagians that were being banished from Rome. And there was rumors that perhaps his teachings really weren't quite orthodox in regards to Christ's personality. So Celestine commissioned another early church father, Cyril of Alexandria, to make an investigation and to report back to him. And Cyril, having found Nestorius openly professing his heresy, sent a full account to the Pope. who in the Roman Synod of 430 solemnly condemned the errors of Nestorianists and ordered Cyril in his name to proceed against Nestorius, who was to be excommunicated and deposed unless within 10 days he should have made in writing a solemn retraction of his errors. So, this good Pope, St. Celestine I, was the first to really go after with hammer and tongs this whole Nestorian problem. And also, just a little factoid, too, is that this early church father may sound familiar to some people out there. And the reason is because one of the last official acts of this pope, Pope St. Celestine I, sent St. Patrick to Ireland. And so the conversion of Ireland, is largely, although not solely, but largely attributed to St. Patrick. Well, guess what? We have today's Meet the Early Church Father to thank for that, because Pope St. Celestine I sending St. Patrick to Ireland was more than perhaps anybody else responsible for the conversion of that country. And, in light of some of the, some of the troubles that have developed within Ireland and the church, it's good for us to perhaps say a prayer today and ask for the intercession of Pope St. Celestine I, not to mention St. Patrick as well. On the other side of the break, we're going to be chatting with Father Robert Spitzer about the soul. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. There's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Are we just biological machines kind of working on a genetic algorithm? basically just Mother Nature's version of a computer? Or is there some aspect to us that transcends the physical? Well, there's no one on earth, I believe, better suited to discuss this with us than our guest, Father Robert Spitzer. Father Spitzer was the president of Gonzaga University from 1998 to 2009. He made many TV appearances, including Larry King Live, The Today Show, the History Channel in God and the Universe, and a multi-part PBS series, Closer to the Truth, as well as The Hugh Hewitt Show. He's also currently doing a weekly program on EWTN in Father Spitzer's universe. He runs the Magis Center and also an incredible website. So if you have a pen and paper, jot this down, www.credibleCatholic.com. It's a great resource, lots of information. Avail yourselves of that. It's www.credibleCatholic.com. And we're going to be talking about his book, The Soul's Upward Yearning, Clues to Our Transcendent Nature from Experience and Reason. Father Robert Spitzer, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, thank you, Gary. Great to be with you.
Oh, it's great to be with you, too. You know, I was on the Magis Center website, and I was reading some of your thesis that you wrote. And it's, I'd love to talk to you about, there's some fascinating stuff, you know, say Thomas Aquinas' work on being an essence and yeah, early Christological creeds. Man, those theses sound great.
Oh, yeah. No, I was born into philosophy of science and metaphysics. I mean, this goes all the way back to my ninth grade. So, I mean, I just have to tell you, I mean, science and metaphysical questions, infinity, God, I mean, these were on my mind since I was a very young man, and kept right on going all the way through college and then right into graduate school. And, of course, these books kind of burst out of me because, as they say, there was no choice. God was inspiring me. I know that. And after the Lord handed off, you know, things, you know, to my good educators, and the Holy Spirit kept inspiring me. I, as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah. Thanks be to God for that, because you've done such tremendous work. You know, we're really grateful for everything you've done. And in fact, especially today, where there is such a crisis, especially with people younger than myself, that there's this idea that, well, there's nothing special about humans. Humans are no different than any other species. We're just more evolved. There's really, they've forgotten this idea that we have a transcendent soul.
Yeah, they really have. And part of it goes back to their science education, unfortunately. You know, in their ninth grade biology class, they already become, in fact, sometimes as early as seventh grade, already that closet materialism, you know, you're just a bunch of atoms and molecules anyway, that just comes out in spades. And even if a teacher might think, you know, about a soul or have some faith in a soul, unfortunately, the teacher in the biology class, either by sheer dint of you know, poor pedagogy or by implication, seems to convey to the students that they don't have a soul. They're just reducible to atoms and molecules. And so as a result, even in our Catholic schools, we've got a majority of closet materialists out there, and they really don't believe there's a transcendent soul, except for one little problem. At this particular point in time, there's more evidence for a transcendent soul than we've ever had in the whole history of humankind. I mean, if you want some kind of empirical hyphen rational access to a soul, I mean, now's the time. I mean, obviously, you had the great five transcendental desires with Plato. That was a big, huge clue that in the history of philosophy, we've never given it up. To this very day, we've got a whole host of philosophers and philosophers of science that clearly make recourse to that. And, of course, the whole problem of self-consciousness articulated so beautifully by St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. Again, the immaterialism and transmaterialism implications of self-consciousness are writ large in our history, but even more today. You know, there's so much being written about this, especially at Oxford University, where David Chalmers and people of that nature are, you know, really breaking the boundaries and saying, hey, physical reductionism isn't going to work. Now, they're, of course, searching around as quickly as they can, you know, for, you know, anything, you know, but, you know, any transphysical cause except God. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're being backed into the God corner. A lot of them are actually not foreclosing the option nearly as radically or as quickly as they used to. So that's a good thing. I mean, but and then, of course, you know, not just, you know, going way beyond our history. I mean, self-consciousness and the five transcendental desires, we incorporated those, you know, access points into a transphysical soul a long time ago. But then conceptual ideas, you know, we've always known there was something about them, you know, that manifested a transphysical physical quality. And St. Thomas Aquinas, once again, was the person who really articulated that so beautifully. In the first part of the second part, the Summa Theologica, there are arguments there, especially first part of the second part, question 76, you know, where, you know, I mean, Karl Rahner, for example, wrote whole books about it, you know, Geist im Welt, you know, the spirit in the world, you know, area. And of course, Hans Urs von Balthasar, so many others have talked about, you know, this dimension of human beings. But it really, again, you know, that transphysical component of ideas really does go back to Plato and Aristotle, embraced, of course, by St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas. So in our tradition, we really did articulate this very, very well. And it still is in the whole area, philosophy of mind is what they call it in that specialty area today. And a lot of people, are working on this. And I've got a lot of references to it in the Soul's Upward Yearning. But there are three elements today that really bring the arguments for transphysical soul to a whole new level. The first area is two empirical areas, the peer-reviewed medical studies of near-death experiences, which are truly remarkable. I mean, that's where you get the 81% of blind people see for the first time when they're clinically dead. Flat EEG, fixed and dilated pupils, no gag reflex, no electrical activity in the cerebral cortex, mere sputterings of neurons in the lower brain. And all of a sudden, when you're literally on the verge of brain death, you suddenly get vision for the first time. You know, people are reporting veridical data, or they're accurately reporting everything that's going on in the operating room, or just everything going on in the waiting room next door, or things going on in the hospital that can be validated by independent researchers after the fact. I mean, you know, how are you going to deny that these people are actually seeing, hearing, remembering, and recalling accurately what's going on without a physical brain? I mean, the evidence is overwhelming in this day and age. And then you now have these studies of terminal lucidity, where people who, you know, have had severe Alzheimer's or severe dementia, or looking at, you know, maybe some people for many, many years have since birth maybe have had an IQ less than 60, or, you know, hydrocephalus, you know, where, you know, the water on the brain has literally eliminated, you know, 90% of their brains. And all of a sudden, all these people who have absolutely no capacity for conceptual thought from their brains are basically finished off. And all of a sudden, these people wake up 1 hour to 1 day before they die, and they start talking just like you and me, without a functional physical brain. And they're saying, you know, oh gosh, I got to take care of my funeral arrangements, and you know, my will is incomplete. And by the way, you're never going to believe what happened to me. Blah 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 blah. And these people are talking, and all these researchers and doctors are going, how are they doing this? I mean, we got on the MRI, they don't have a brain that they can possibly be doing this, and yet they are doing it, and for a full hour or whatever before death, and then they die. You know, and now you look at that and you go, well, if they weren't doing it with their physical brain, then how were they thinking? There must be some locus of consciousness, of vision, et cetera, that transcends, the physical soul. The same thing, I mean, the physical body, the same thing that we see with respect to near-death experiences. So that's one whole area of research that's really, really interesting. And then you have a whole other set of things that's going on in philosophy of mind in the current age that goes, you know, this is not known really by our tradition, as well. And Gödel's theorem is one of them. And we can talk about that in detail in just a moment. But that shows essentially that human beings do mathematics in a way that you know, a computer can't do mathematics. Computers really do need a set of algorithmic functions that tell them precisely how to process data. Whereas human beings, we can show this by means of this proof of Kurt Gödel, who is a very, very well-known mathematician for the incompleteness theorems. But anyway, Gödel shows that human beings sort of grasp the whole of mathematical intelligibility as a whole. And then they sort of recognize the errors that are there, or the incompleteness in a particular set of algorithms, and the path to move beyond the algorithms without making recourse to a previous set of algorithms. See, every computer, in order to correct itself, would have to make recourse to something in a previous set of algorithms. Human beings do not do anything like that. They creatively reinvent, as it were, mathematics from the top down instead of, as computers do, from the bottom up, from the previous set of algorithms. And so they can actually self-correct without making recourse to those algorithms. And that makes human mathematical ability completely creative. We could have never proceeded to where we are today if we were like computers. And Gödel has shown this, and people take this so seriously. I mean, great physicists like Roger Penrose, et cetera, that they take it so seriously. I mean, just volumes and volumes have been written about this, trying to explain, well, how can we do that? Well, we don't do it with a physical brain. If we, basically, if all we have is a physical brain, even if we have some kind of, quantum computational capability in our physical brain, we are still going to be limited by the previous set of algorithms. We'll never be able to get to the point of mathematical transcendence in the way pointed to by Gödel's theorem. So essentially, that, again, in the modern age, shows there is something about human beings that's transphysical, something about human beings that's grasping intelligibility of mathematics as a whole and not just simply by working at it from the bottom up. And I know we've got a break coming, so we can explain a couple of other really exciting things in a couple minutes.
Awesome. Thank you. We're talking with Father Robert Spitzer about the soul. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th. At the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with Father Robert Spitzer about the soul. And Father just gave a great explanation of Gödel's theorem. And Father, you know, I always understood it as essentially what he's saying is, if you have a maze and you put a mechanical mouse in the maze and it just randomly goes through it, it may never find the exit. But there's something about us humans that not only do we see the twists and turns, but we can intellectually see the whole maze itself and figure out where the exits are.
Well, that's a good analogy. I think it is a good analogy because basically, you know, a lot of people think that mathematics, for example, is just, you know, I build up, I just keep compiling algorithm after algorithm in the past. And, as I just keep piling these things, I get to more and more complex solutions and conclusions. And so mathematics develops that way. But what Gödel shows is, no, that's not the way, you know, mathematics develops. You pile up past algorithms, right, past rules through which mathematical operations can be done. You pile them up, and then you come to an impasse. Now, here's the problem with coming to the impasse, is that you can't use the previous set of algorithms to resolve the impasse. That's why you're at the impasse. And so, you know, all the computer can try and do when it gets to the impasse, all it can do is use the previous set of algorithms, and it can, you know, it can cast around and try to utilize everything that it has to resolve the impasse, but it won't be able to do so. That's why it's at the impasse, and so it just will sit there. And the reason is it's lacking something. There's something in the past set of rules and operations, what we call algorithms, that will not permit it to go any further. So a human being, however, can look at that impasse and go, oh, well, what's missing is this and this. So if we formulate two new rules that go beyond anything in the past rules and operations, then we can go ahead and advance mathematics to solve the problem that created the impasse. Now, a computer can't do that. But how can human beings do that? That implies either that human beings have all those operations in their head, unlikely, or human beings have this uncanny grasp of mathematical intelligibility as a whole. And having this kind of uncanny grasp of how mathematical intelligibility works as a whole, it can then come to, you know, these past algorithms, not only say, okay, here's the problem, here's why we can't solve it, but can also say, you know, by just bringing in these two new operations that we didn't have before. Let's say you were stuck on a problem of trigonometry or geometry. You could say, oh, you know, I could use this particular technique in the calculus or this particular technique in analytical geometry to resolve this. But of course, they're not in the past algorithms. You're going to have to develop new rules and operations to get to the calculus. So what we call derivative operations, or integral operations, or even triple integral operations, et cetera, et cetera. We get to another set of problems that we can't resolve even with calculus. And we go, what do we need here? Well, it's not going to be resolved by linear equations. We're going to need some non-linear mathematics. And then we can, apply, our computational operations to do a set of what might be called non-linear sets to resolve that. Well, that's just not written in the past. All we have are linear algebra. You're not going to get to non-linear solutions to problems. I mean, it was human genius. It was the human grasp of mathematics that created non-linear equations. And the same thing. Here's Albert Einstein. He's looking, trying to resolve the space-time problem. How are we going to integrate, mass and gravity into the three forces of nature in a way that will enable us to see the effects on the geometry of the universe as a whole? And he comes up with what we call the tensor. But the tensor has all kinds of elements in it that are simply not present in any form of past Euclidean and even some non-Euclidean geometries. It's a completely creative solution that comes from a human mind. I mean, all the computer can do is burn itself out trying to use the past set of operations and rules to resolve an impasse which it can't resolve from the rules. That's why it's at the impasse. Human beings transcend the impasse, find a solution from mathematical intelligibility as a whole, create the new rules and operations from, at that point, we proceed further. So this is really the most amazing thing in the world. We have no comprehension of how this can be done in any physicalist operation, because a physical process is essentially an algorithmic process. Even a quantum physical process, it has, at the end of the day, some kind of, limitation to the physical processes of the algorithms from which it was derived. Therefore, human beings are not reducible to physical processes, not reducible to mere algorithmic process, not even quantum computational algorithmic processes. We are transcendent. We do mathematics from the top down. I mean, the true mathematicians do, whereas, quite frankly, computers can only do it from the bottom up, and that means every 10 minutes it's going to reach an impasse which it can't resolve. You need a spiritual mind, if I can put it, a transphysical mind that can grasp intelligibility of mathematics as a whole to do this. And I think that, I don't think that has ever been resolved. I mean, I think it sends poor Roger Penrose, to the brink. He's, ever since he wrote The Emperor's New Mind, he's been trying to do, to find, but in The Emperor's New Mind, I mean, what is he calling it? It's a new mind. You're going to need something beyond the computer to get to the solution, of Gödel's theorem, which stands out there to this very day, right? I mean, he was doing all this in the 20s and the 30s, the incompleteness theorems. And, of course, here we are almost 100 years later, and we're still scratching our heads, I mean, I leave it at that. But, we've got heuristic notions, a variety of other things. And I mean, all the self-consciousness studies, too, and all the new philosophy of mind things being done with David Chalmers. I mean, this is an age where if you can't see the soul today with near-death experiences and terminal lucidity, Gödel's theorem, heuristic notions, the self-consciousness studies, that have been done, and then all the comparisons to animals, right, where we can see that this highly trained chimpanzees like Nim Chomsky, I mean, they can actually learn between 120 to 200 signs, the really highly trained, intelligent chimpanzees with a well-developed frontal lobe, they can learn 120 signs to 200 signs in American Sign Language. Yet, they cannot use one of those signs as a predicate or an object. That is to say, as a concept or a category which can stand for multiple objects. It's not just stand for, it has to stand on its own independent of the objects from which it was derived. They can't even do that. They can't distinguish between dog bites man and man bites dog. They have no recognition of syntax a direct object or a predicate, and so when you say to the little child who's 2 years old, what's the difference between dog bites man and man bites dog? The two-year-old laughs at the prospect of the man biting the dog, because a clearly understanding, the proposition. Whereas the chimpanzee can learn the sign for man, the sign for dog, and the sign for bite, and have no recognition of the difference between them, because all he can do is subject to subject. He can't do subject to object or subject to predicate, and he just can't get that big categorical conceptual idea of dogness and manness and bitingness. It just can't get there because, again, no soul. And by the way, there's a very, very good proof of this kind of stuff that's not just in our tradition, but certainly St. Thomas Aquinas talked about, conceptual intelligence in what he called abstraction. And of course, Bernard Lonergan talks about it hugely in Insight, when he's talking about universals. Study of human understanding, but of course it's present even today. By the way, all the neo-Kantians, hold this too, because you've got a real problem. He has to distinguish between the noumena and phenomena, because the noumenon is abstract categories, whereas phenomena are derived from experience. And so, this has been long recognized, but today in our century, it has been very, very well developed, beyond what we see, St. Thomas's day, particularly with respect to showing that animals like highly trained chimpanzees, very intelligent, well-developed frontal lobes, just simply can't do it. I mean, so they can get signs, but they can't do a sentence. They'll never do syntax. And that shows what St. Thomas Aquinas and Augustine were saying all along. So you've got these peculiarly contemporary validations of our very good tradition. And by the way, those five transcendental desires for perfect truth, justice, goodness, beauty, and home, I mean, we're validating it today more than ever, course, nothing has changed. Plato's insight which he developed long ago, along with St. Augustine, which is being validated day by day in the current age. So, I mean, this is just, if you read my book, The Soul's Upward Yearning, I've really got a huge elucidation of it with a lot of footnotes.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, The Soul's Upward Yearning, folks. You need to pick it up. More on the other side of the break. You listen to Hands-On Apologetics with Father Robert Spitzer. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. There's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-1220. 2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with the incomparable Father Robert Spitzer and having a great discussion. I have a feeling a lot of people out there are taking notes or they're going to be watching the or listening again to the podcast. Father, there's one thing I'd like to talk a little bit about. We have about 13 minutes, but I know you're capable of doing it because if there's anybody on earth that can talk about this in 13 minutes, it's you. Heuristic notions. Because I think that kind of fits in with Gödel's theorem.
Yes, it does. I mean, this is one of the most mysterious parts of what we call epistemology, you know, the whole area of human knowing and how do we know. And let me just kind of, you know, we were talking about predicates and direct objects just a few moments ago. And here's the what St. Thomas Aquinas noticed a long time ago, and I'm going to put it into a contemporary terms. You know, Bernard Lonergan uses the word heuristic notions, and I think it's a really good handy term to talk about how this, you know, occurs in human language. And so when we have, you know, like a particular word, like, you know, Gary Machuda. That refers to a single person, a single object, and, you know, you can have an image of that object. And so you can have a picture thought of Gary Machuda. You can have a picture thought of the phone I have in my hand right now. You can have a picture thought of the tree outside your home, etc. Now, here's the thing. You can't have human language with only picture thoughts. And the reason you can't is because picture thoughts only give you singular objects. And in order to say something about something, you're going to have what we call some categories. You're going to have to abstract away from singularity. You're going to abstract away from the thisness of that object. You're going to have to be able to refer to trees in general. And so, you know, the question arose a long time ago. And by the way, Plato and Aristotle recognized this. They knew it was the biggest problem and gave rise to a theory called the agent intellect theory. But what they said is, okay, so you're going to have a category. In other words, to say trees are green, you're going to have to be able to refer to greenness that's not a picture thought. But, you know, an idea is what we call it, an idea of greenness, a concept of greenness, which is not something that can come into my imagination, but refers to everything that could be green. And so just to hold on for just a second. And again, if I'm going to talk about, trees are large, I'm going to have to come up with a notion of large. But what picture thought do you have for large? In fact, listen to every word I am saying right now. What picture thought do you, you, of course, is a picture, have of large? I get it? Like 95% of the words we're using have no picture thought, no image correlate, right? So we're using words that are not like might have been derived from pictures, but they're not pictures anymore. And so we're thinking, what are these things? And what we call them are, we say, they're relational concepts. They come from relationships of objects among objects. So when I look at the spectrum, right, that's going through a prism, et cetera, I can begin to refer to the relationship of one color to another by their wavelength, for example. But that's just getting too technical. I'm way, way ahead of myself. But the main thing is there are two kinds of things. There are words that refer to single objects, and there are words that refer to relationships among objects. So people start thinking about this, and they go, well, wait a minute. Where did we get all these, conceptual words from? We're going to have some kind of a superstructure, something to organize these relational, words. So as a matter of fact, we have like six major superstructures, and I'm going to tell you, I think these are innate. They're not innate to our brain. The brain is a physical processing unit, right? They're innate to our mind, which I'm going to call to our transphysical soul. They're just embedded there. And what are these things? They're the six major questions: what, where, when, why, how, and how many. Now, if we didn't have these five organizational structures in our mind, we'd never be able to form relationships among objects. So let's take where. That's easy. Because where, you could say, well, what's the relational superstructure around where? Well, pretty much it's like a map, right? So, you have a whole superstructure. You don't have to put north, south, east, west in there yet. You don't even have to put left, right in there. But you're organizing a superstructure. So you see places in relation to other places. So it's no longer do I just say, well, there's Covina and there's Orange, right? I can just simply I can see them in relationship to one another. The minute I have that map-like categorical structure that enables me to see things right in relationship to one another. So that's the first thing. So I've got something like an abstract map in my mind, not in my brain, but in my mind. I have this huge abstraction I'll call where, this huge thing that knows to put up an abstract map, that sees places and locations in relation to each other. The same thing with what. What is going to tell me, right, similarities and differences among objects? Again, relationships among objects. I have this big, huge, abstract thing called what, which sets up relations in my mind. It's like that map was, except it's a different abstract structure around which I can, relate objects to one another, so I can see the similarities and the differences among objects. Human beings are rational animals. Dogs are non-rational animals, etc. So I can have species and specific differences and genuses, etc., etc. So that's what. And then I can also have why, where I relate things causally to one another. This is a cause of these effects, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, I also have a big, huge structure called when, where I can actually, I just don't, you know, times are not processed. Times are unified and set in relationship to one another as before and after. Well, just think now, I've got how many, which quantitative, right? And so I have these six different, you know, mental abstract maps. Let's call those big, huge mental abstract maps, for which each of the six major questions are kind of representatives of how they originate. Let's call them heuristic notions. Let's just say that these abstract maps, are, there are organizing structures. They're the ways we can set, you know, all the objects that we're seeing, all the perceptual objects that we're seeing, we can set them in relationship to one another around one of these six huge abstract mental maps. And by the way, we can even have relationships among relationships, but that's too complicated for right now. But here's the point, and here's the question that has boggled people for centuries. Hey, wait a minute. Could we have ever derived those heuristic notions, those huge mental maps, which are our organizational structures for setting objects in relationship to, with one another, could we have ever derived those from experience without having them already in our minds? In other words, in order for you to get one little abstraction like the word green, like we were just talking about, that doesn't represent a specific blotch or image of green in your picture thinking, but really can stand in relationship, to stand for every green object that there is, could we have ever gotten one little abstraction like that without having the heuristic notions? The answer is no. But how then could we ever have derived heuristic notions from experience? They have to be innate. They have to, because you would have had to have used them to derive them from experience, which of course is a vicious circle, which you're never going to get out of. And people finally said, hey, wait a minute. There's got to be at least six big mental maps inside of what? Our brain? No, our brain is a bunch of algorithmically finite processes, as we just said 2 seconds ago. Well, if the brain is algorithmically finite processes, which are imbued in singularity, right? They've got, you know, as it were, the empirical residue. They're not abstract themselves. If the brain is a non-abstract thing, then what is it that can actually contain, as it were, these heuristic notions that are innate to the way we do thinking? It has to be a transphysical soul which has these six derivative notions in some sense, you know, present to it, which enables us to do the abstracting, because we could have never gotten the abstractions from our brains, could have never gotten those huge, big abstract mental maps from our physical processes of our brains, and we certainly couldn't have gotten it from experience. All of our experiences, remember, are imbued with singularity itself, imbued with individuality itself, imbued with empirical residue itself. If that's the case, then I'm telling you, there's something that in human thinking that transcends it all, that enables us to have these six abstract things there. And basically, in a nutshell, that's the problem. It's the vicious circle. I mean, you can read about it in Bernard Lonergan. He reduces it to a single heuristic notion called the notion of being, which is so brilliantly done. He actually shows that the six big mental maps for all of our questions are actually derived from a single notion called the notion of being, and that is a brilliant thing. It's also there in the first part of the second part of the Summa Theologica, at least it's there incipiently, question 76, and so forth. So there's a lot of really good stuff in our tradition that's there, but the contemporary articulation shows that we are ensouled. Transphysical soul that's not only going to survive bodily death, but makes us created in the image of God.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Father. You deserve a medal. That was perfectly lucid. And you did it within time. So thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Gary. Always a pleasure.
It's Father Robert Spitzer and the Soul's Upward Yearning, Clues to Our Transcendent Nature from Experience of Reason. Pick it up, folks. Great material. Coming up next, the Terry and Jesse Show. And coming up tomorrow, actually, disciple of Father Spitzer, Carlo Brassard, is coming to talk about the hiddenness of God. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.